20. I'm worried about you, Francis, Mom said. Go away. Frankie rolled over, put her pillow over her head. How long had it been since she'd lost Rye? 3 days? 4? Frankie, go away! A gentle touch on her shoulder. Francis? Frankie played dead until Mom sighed heavily and left the room, closing the door behind her. Frankie eased the pillow off of her face. Did Mom think that Frankie had moved on already? At that, her grief expanded again. She let it submerge her. Strangely, there was peace in the nothingness, comfort in her pain. At least Rye was with her here in this darkness. She let herself imagine the life they would have had, the children who looked like them. That hurt too much to bear. She drew back, tried to push the thought away. It wouldn't leave. Rye, she whispered, reaching for a man who wasn't there.
Francis. Francis.
Frankie heard her mother's voice coming at her from far away.
Leave.
Francis, open your eyes. You're scaring me.
Frankie rolled over, opened her eyes, stared blearily up at her mother, who was dressed for church.
I'm not going to church, Frankie said.
Her voice felt thick, or maybe that was her tongue. Mom picked up the empty glass on the nightstand. Beside it was an empty bottle of gin.
You're drinking too much.
Takes one to know one, Frankie said.
Dad said he saw you wandering in the living room, sleepwalking, maybe.
Who cares?
Mom stepped closer.
You lost someone you think you loved. It hurts, I know, but life goes on.
Think I loved?
Frankie rolled over and closed her eyes, thinking, Rye, remember our first kiss? She was asleep before her mother left the room. Frankie became aware of the music in stages. First the beat, then the rhythm, then at last the words. The Doors. Light My Fire. She was in Nam, at the O Club, dancing with Rye. She felt his arms around her, felt his hips pressed against hers, his hand settling possessively in the curve at the base of her spine. He whispered something, and it made her feel cold, afraid. What? She asked. Say it again. But he was pulling away, leaving her alone. Suddenly, the music blared, turned loud enough to hurt her ears, sounded like a red alert. She sat up, groggy, headachy, pushed the damp hair out of her eyes. Her lashes were stuck together. Grit itched at the corners of her eyes. The music snapped off.
Sleepin' Beauty awakes.
Not so much beauty, but plenty of sleepin'.
Frankie turned her head, saw Ethel and Barb standing in her bedroom. Ethel was heavier than she'd been in Vietnam, with rounded curves that had filled out her tall frame. Her red hair was pulled into a low side ponytail. She wore bell-bottom jeans and a striped polyester tunic top. Barb wore black corduroy pants and a black t-shirt and an olive-colored military-type jacket with the sleeves cut off.
Get out of bed, Frankie, Barb said.
My mom called in reinforcements, Frankie said.
I called, actually, Barb said. I hadn't heard from you since we talked about Rye's coming home party. I got worried and called. Your mother answered the phone.
Get out of bed, Frank, or I'll throw you over my shoulder, Ethel said. Don't think I won't. I can lift a bale of hay.
Frankie knew there was no point arguing. She saw the way they looked at her, with a mixture of compassion and resolve. They were here to lift her out of despair. It was in the way they looked, the way they stood, the confidence set to their chins. They wanted her to just get up, stand, start to walk, as if grief were a pool you could simply step out of. In reality, it was quicksand and heat. A rough entry, but warm and inviting once you let go. She pushed the sour, sweat-smelling covers back and got out of bed. Without making eye contact, she couldn't look at them without thinking of Rye, she walked down the hall to her bathroom and took a shower.
trying dully to remember when she'd last turned the water on or washed her hair. She towel-dried her hair and put on the clothes she'd left hanging on a hook on the back of the door, clothes her mother had bought to cheer her up, a blue tunic and pants set with a pointed white sailor collar and a white cinch belt. She felt like an actress dressing for the role of dutiful daughter. Ridiculous. But the effort it took to choose something else was beyond her. Barefoot, she walked back into her bedroom. At the sight of her friends standing there, she knew how much she loved them. She could almost feel that love, but not quite. Grief had bludgeoned away every other emotion. "I'm fine, you know," Frankie said. "Apparently you've been in bed for well over a week," Ethel said. "Time flies when you're having fun." "Come on, Frank," Ethel said, linking her arm through Frankie's. Barb grabbed the radio and moved to Frankie's other side, a flanking maneuver to make sure Frankie was hemmed in. The trio walked down the hallway. Frankie pulled them past her father's office. The last thing she wanted them to see was the hero's wall and her absence on it. Frankie was surprised that they seemed to know the house and have a plan. They walked through the yard, across the street, and out to the beach, where three empty chairs and a portable ice chest waited for them. Barb set the radio on the ice chest and cranked up the music. Frankie felt unsteady, listening to the surf roar toward her. The familiar music took her back to the best of Vietnam and the worst. "I loved him," she said out loud. Barb handed her a gin and tonic, said, "Sit, Frankie." Frankie didn't sit so much as she collapsed. Ethel sat down beside her, held her hand. Barb sat in the third chair. The three of them held hands, stared out at the Pacific Ocean crashing beautifully onto the shore, the constant, ceaseless battering of water, the quiet retreat of each wave. Frankie said, "How could I not know he was gone? How could I not feel his loss from the world?" For that, there was no answer. The three of them knew death intimately, had stood side by side with it for years. "You need to do something," Ethel said. "Start a life." "There's this group," Barb said, "Vietnam Veterans Against the War. It started with six vets marching in a peaceful protest to end the war. Maybe you could take your anger and use it for something good." Anger? That was a distant shadow on the horizon of her grief. Barb had no idea how this felt, how debilitating it was to lose yourself along with your love. And Frankie couldn't explain it without sounding pathetic or worrying them more. Best to just say, "Life has to go on, Frank," Ethel said. "You're tough enough for Play Coup. You can survive this." "Ah, life goes on. But does it really? Not the same life, that was for sure." "I love you," she said, knowing that her friends wanted to help, but how could they? How could anyone? They were just telling her what she'd heard before. The only way out was through. More platitudes. The question was, how? How did you get through grief? How did you want to live again when you couldn't imagine what that life could be? How you could be happy again? It was a question that hadn't occurred to her before. She'd done her best to exist, or not exist, really, in the safety of her bed, with the covers pulled up. But even she knew that couldn't go on forever. What did she want? Rye? A wedding? A baby to hold in her arms? A home of her own? "How has it been, coming home?" Barb asked. "Besides finding out that the man I love is dead?" Frankie said. "Before that," was Ethel's softly spoken answer. "Tough," Frankie said. "No one wants to talk about the war. My father is ashamed of me even going." She looked at her friends. "So what did you two do?" Ethel shrugged. "You know my story. I started vet school and fell back in love with my high school boyfriend, Noah. He was in country while I was, but we never saw each other. He knew how much I love George. We have history. When I'm feeling fragile, he has a way of holding me together." Frankie nodded. You have nightmares? Not much. Anymore, Ethel said, at the same time Barb said,
You've got to push it aside, Frankie. Do something.
What do you have left, Frank? Ethel asked after a while, when the music changed to something folky and soft. No anger in this music, just sadness and loss and sorrow.
What do you mean?
You tell me.
Well,
honestly, this was something Frankie had never thought about. She knew who she'd been raised to be, what was expected of her, but that was before, wasn't it? Barb repeated the question.
What do you have left?
Frankie thought about how she'd changed in the past 2 years, what she'd learned about herself and the world, about Jamie and her certainty that she had to do the right thing, which meant that she'd never even kissed him. She thought about Rye and how their passion had transformed her, loosened her into a different, bolder version of herself. She thought about Finn and their idyllic childhood, the way he'd told her, it's okay, and she'd believed him. All of them, the three men she'd loved, had awakened her, filled her heart, made her happy. But they couldn't be everything.
Nursing, she said softly.
Damn right, Ethel said. You are a shit-kicking, take-no-prisoners good nurse. You save lives, Frank. Think about that.
Frankie nodded. She sensed a glimmer of possibility, a way to move around her grief. In helping others, maybe she could find a way to help herself.
You guys are the best, she said, her voice breaking. And I love you, truly.
She got to her feet, turned, looked at them. They were here to help her, but she knew, as they knew, if she were to be saved, she'd have to do it herself. In the next few days, Frankie showed Ethel and Barb all the places she'd loved as a child. The three friends spent long hours on the beach just talking, listening to the music that made them laugh and cry and remember. By the time her best friends left, Frankie had a plan for going forward. She spent days scouring the want ads in the San Diego newspaper and making calls. When she finally scored an interview, she got up early to prepare. She typed up a resume on the IBM Selectric on her father's desk that no one in this house ever used. Her mother believed, of course, in handwritten letters, and her father had secretaries to type for him. When she was happy with it, she zipped it off the roll, reread for typos, and then slid it into the lambskin leather briefcase that had been her high school graduation gift. It was the first time she'd used it. Her initials, FGM, were stamped in gold on the black leather. Grateful, for once, that her mother was an ardent shopper, Frankie found a suitable two-piece striped dress with a funnel neck and a hip-hugging green belt hanging in her closet. Her top dresser drawer held an array of rolled-up panties, a few lacy bras, and some pantyhose in the cinnamon hue Frankie and all her high school friends had worn in the winter to look tan. She slipped her feet into a pair of low-heeled camel pumps. From the ferry's car deck, she saw the almost completed bridge. Huge concrete stanchions rose out of the wavy blue water, curving from one shore toward the other. On the mainland, the small hospital was housed in a mission-style white building that took up a city block, its front and side yards studded with palm trees. Frankie parked in the visitor's lot and walked to the front door. The minute the doors opened and welcomed her in, she smelled the familiar scents of disinfectant, alcohol, bleach. And for the first time since coming home, she felt like herself. This was where she belonged, who she was. Here, she would find a path through her grief. She went to the front desk, where a bouffant-haired young woman greeted her with a smile and pointed the way to the director of nursing's office on the second floor. Frankie's hand on the briefcase's leather handle was damp. This was only her second real job interview. Military recruitment didn't count. She knew that she looked young. Was young, at least chronologically. She found the office she was looking for, two doors down from the elevator on the second floor. Outside of it, she stopped, took a breath. No fear, McGrath. Standing tall, shoulders back, chin up, as she'd been taught by her parents and the nuns at St. Bernadette's, she walked up to the door that read, "Mrs. Dolores Smart, Director of Nursing," and knocked. Mrs. Smart looked up from the work on her desk. She had a round face with bright red cheeks and wore her gray hair in old-fashioned pin curls that lay flat against her head. Behind her, a large window overlooked the parking lot.
"Mrs. Smart, I'm Frances McGrath, here for an interview."
"Come in," the older woman said, indicating the empty chair in front of her desk. "Your resume?" Frankie sat down, took the folder out of her briefcase, and slid it across the desk. Mrs. Smart read it.
"St. Bernadette's," she said. "Good grades."
"I graduated at the top of my nursing school class at the San Diego College for Women."
"I see that. You worked for a couple of weeks at St. Barnabas. Night shift."
"Yes, but as you can see, I just returned from Vietnam, ma'am, where I was an army nurse for 2 years. I worked my way up to surgical nurse, and..."
"You are hardly trained for surgical assistance," Mrs. Smart said crisply.
She pushed her glasses up and stared at Frankie.
"Can you follow instructions, Miss McGrath? Do as you're told?"
"Believe me, ma'am, the military demands it. And my Vietnam training has made me an exceptional nurse."
Mrs. Smart tapped her pen on the desk as she read and reread Frankie's resume. Finally, she said,
"Report to Mrs. Henderson at the first floor nurse's station Wednesday at 11 p.m. for your first night of work. Tilda, in the office next to mine, will set you up with a uniform."
"You're hiring me?"
"I'm putting you on probation. 11 p.m. to 7 a.m.
"The night shift?"
"Of course. It's where all beginners start, Miss McGrath. You should know that."
"But
no buts. Do you want to work here?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Good. See you Wednesday."
On her first day of work, Frankie dressed in a starched white uniform with an apron, thick white stockings, and comfortable white shoes. The nurse's cap sat on her teased, precision-cut bob like a flag of surrender. In Nam, in the shit, it would have fallen into some patient's gaping ab wound or been splattered with blood. She arrived ready to work, was shown to her locker, and given a key. At precisely 2300 hours, she reported to the night charge nurse, Mrs. Henderson, an elderly woman in white who had a face like a bull terrier's, complete with whiskers.
"Frances McGrath, ma'am, reporting for duty."
"It's not the army, Miss McGrath. You can just say hello. I hear you have almost no hospital experience."
Frankie frowned. "Well, civilian, maybe, but I was in Vietnam at a mobile..."
"Follow me. I'll get you started."
The charge nurse walked fast, her shoulders squared, her chin tucked in, her head on a swivel.
"You are on probation, Miss McGrath. I assume Mrs. Smart relayed this information to you. Our patients are important to us, and we strive to offer the highest caliber of care, which means, of course, that nurses who know next to nothing do next to nothing. I will tell you when you can treat actual patients. For now, you may help patients to the restroom, refill their water, change bedpans, and man the phone at the nurse's station."
"But I know how..." Another hand held up for silence.
"Here's the emergency room. You'll see everything here, from a heart attack to marbles stuck up a kid's nostril."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Good sign. Politeness. Nowadays, most girls your age act like feral dogs. My granddaughter dresses like a vagrant. Follow me. Keep up. This is the surgical ward. Only highly trained surgical nurses work here."
She kept going on her tour of the hospital. Frankie followed her new boss down the hallway, past half a series of closed doors. She was shown the restrooms, the lab, the equipment room. They ended up back on the first floor at the nurse's station.
"Sit there," Mrs. Henderson said. "Answer the phone. If there's trouble, page me."
Frankie took a seat. "You may help patients to the restroom, refill their water, change bedpans." She took a deep breath and released it. Barb and Ethel had prepared her for this. She'd known it was coming. There was no point being angry. She simply needed to show them what she could do. Good things took time.
April 27th, 1969. "Dear Ethel, I got a job as a nurse in a local hospital. Yay! I hope you can read the sarcasm in that word. Barb was right. They're treating me like I'm a candy striper. Sometimes it makes me so mad I want to scream. They have me on the night shift, answering phones and changing bedpans and refilling water pitchers. Me, on the night shift. The only good thing is the anger sometimes makes me forget how sad I am. I'll stick with it, though, prove myself. I'll bet you're thinking of my first shift in country. I've got this. Thanks for reminding me, by the way. I still love nursing. That's something. So, how's life on the horse farm? Still kicking ass in your classes? How's that new mare coming along? What's her name? Silver Birch? After some book you read in junior high? How's Noah? Love, F. Running, breathing hard. The admin building blows up beside me. A chopper overhead. I look up, see Rye in the pilot's seat. A whistling sound. I scream. The helicopter explodes in the dark sky, blows into pieces. Ash rains down on me. A helmet thuds to the ground at my feet, on fire. Riot melts off the metal. Frankie woke with a start, looked around. At least she wasn't on the floor. That felt like a small victory. She pushed the covers back and got out of bed, not surprised to find that she felt weak. Last night had been a bad one for nightmares. There was no rhyme or reason to it. She had nightmares and mood swings out of the blue. Sometimes she felt as if she were hanging on to the end of a giant undulating rope. It took all her strength not to let go. Putting on her chenille bathrobe, she made her way out to the kitchen, which was empty at 1500 hours. She poured a cup of coffee and carried it out to the patio, where her mother sat at a table by the pool doing a puzzle. There you are, her mom said, setting a puzzle piece aside. Her gaze narrowed, swept Frankie from head to toe. You didn't sleep well again? Frankie shrugged. This vampire shift of yours isn't helping. Maybe not. Frankie sat down. How much longer will they have you working these ghoulish hours? Who knows? It's only been 2 weeks. I don't like it. Me either. She looked at her mother, who she knew saw the sorrow Frankie worked every day to overcome, and also worried about Frankie's unsettling anger, which could flare up without warning. We should go to dinner soon. At the club. Sure, Mom. Whatever. At just past 2200 hours, Frankie drove toward the ferry terminal on Coronado. There were few cars out this late on a weeknight in mid-May. No tourists stumbling from bar to bar, no well-dressed couples walking to their cars after dinner out. The island was tucked in for the night already, and Frankie was going to work. She intended to be early to start her shift, as usual. It was something she'd learned in Vietnam. In San Diego, the hospital was brightly illuminated. She parked beneath a palm tree and headed inside, waving to colleagues on her way to the lockers. She smiled tightly, hopeful that no one detected the rabid frustration she felt with every shift. They still treated her like an FNG. They didn't even let her start an IV. Still, she kept her mouth shut and soldiered on, as she had been taught to do. At her locker, she changed into her uniform and headed for the nurse's station to take her place at the desk. As usual, the halls were quiet. Most of the patients were sleeping, their doors closed. Frankie's first chore was always to check each room, each patient, and to call for help if it was needed. She poured herself a styrofoam cup full of coffee and stood at the desk, sipping it. An elderly man shuffled toward her, moving as if in pain, his shoulders hunched. She put down her coffee. He was dressed in an old-fashioned way, tan slacks and a crisply ironed white shirt.
Nurse?
Yes, sir?
I'm Jose Garcia. My wife, Elena, is having trouble breathing.
Frankie nodded. She knew she should call Mrs. Henderson, ask for reinforcements. But she didn't. Screw it. Whatever was happening with Mrs. Garcia, Frankie could handle it. She followed Mr. Garcia to room 111. In the room's only bed, A woman lay still, her body covered in blankets, her head raised slightly on a mound of pillows. Her face was pallid, her mouth hung open. She breathed in and out slowly, making a terrible rattling sound.
"She just started breathing like that,"
Jose said quietly. "How long has she been ill?"
6 months. Cancer of the lungs. Her students come by almost every day, don't they, Elena?"
He touched his wife's hand.
"She is a high school teacher. Fierce,"
he added. He turned to Frankie.
"You heard about the walkouts. Students and teachers protesting inequality in our schools. She was part of that, my Elena. Weren't you?"
He gazed down at his wife.
"She fought to get her students college preparation classes instead of just training for domestic work. You changed lives, mi amor."
His voice caught. Frankie took hold of the woman's gnarled, bony, dry-skinned hand and thought for a moment of all the hands she'd held in Vietnam, all the men and women she'd comforted and cared for. It steadied her, calmed the loud noises in her head. "You're not alone, Elena," she said. "How about some lotion on your hands? I bet that would feel good." 21. On a hot June afternoon, 3 months after her return from Vietnam, Frankie woke from her first decent night's sleep. Maybe she was getting better. She was. She was getting better. She put a robe on over her ski Vietnam t-shirt and panties and headed down to the kitchen for coffee. She found her mother at the kitchen table, dressed for the country club, smoking a cigarette, a cup of coffee beside her, reading the newspaper. Frankie saw the headline. "First Lieutenant Sharon Lane killed in rocket explosion in Vietnam." Mom drew in a sharp breath, slammed the newspaper face down on the table. Then she looked up, tried to smile. "Good morning, dear. Well, good afternoon." Frankie reached for the newspaper. "No," Mom said. Frankie wrenched it away from her mother, turned it over to the article. "Army nurse Sharon Lane is the first, and so far only, nurse to be killed by enemy fire, although 7 nurses have been killed or died during the conflict to date. First Lieutenant Lane died almost instantly when a rocket fragment struck her during an attack at Chu Lai." Frankie put down the paper. Enemy fire. A rocket fragment. Almost instantly.
"Did you know her?"
Mom asked quietly. "No." "And yes, we were all the same in some ways. I could have been her." Frankie closed her eyes, said a silent prayer.
"Maybe you should call in sick for work today."
Frankie opened her eyes. She felt jittery now, anxious, angry. If I called in sick every time I felt sad, I'd never go to work. "I ran into Laura Gillihan yesterday at the Free Brothers Market. She mentioned that Rebecca would love to see you." Frankie poured herself a cup of coffee, stirred in some heavy cream. She was breathing a little fast, felt almost lightheaded. Becky Gillihan. There was a name she hadn't heard in a long time. Once upon a time, they'd been friends. At St. Bernadette's Academy, they'd been inseparable. "She's married, still lives on the island. I could call. Tell her you'll stop by before work. And what else will you do until your shift starts?" Frankie wasn't really listening. She could feel her mother's worried gaze, felt how she was being watched. Frankie should say more, tell her mother that she was okay, not to worry. But the thought of Sharon Lane wouldn't let her go. Almost instantly. She walked down the hall, stripped out of her clothes in her bedroom, and took a long, hot shower, crying for the unknown nurse until her tears ran out. Afterward, she redressed in the clothes she found on her bedroom floor, bell-bottom jeans and an embroidered peasant top, and realized she was shaky from a lack of food. She lit up a cigarette instead of eating. On the kitchen table, she found a note from her mother. "Frances Grace, I spoke to Laura. Rebecca was thrilled at the prospect of seeing you. She asked me to pass along that she is hosting a party for Dana Johnston today at 4 p.m. She invited you. 570 2nd Avenue. We are off to a charity auction in Carlsbad. Home late. Frankie glanced at the clock on the stove. The party had started 15 minutes ago. She didn't want to go to Becky's. In fact, the thought of going made her feel vaguely ill. Could she handle seeing old friends? No. But what was the alternative? Sit in this mausoleum of a house alone, waiting until long after dark to go to work? Or be here when her parents returned? Her mother eyed her nervously all the time, as if she feared Frankie was wired with explosives and one wrong word would set her off. And Dad seemed determined not to look at her at all. She'd promised Barb and Ethel that she would do more than endure, that she would engage. This was as good a place to start as any. She ate a piece of Wonder Bread, slathered with butter and sprinkled with sugar, and headed back to her room for her shoes and handbag. It occurred to her that she should expend a little effort with her hair and makeup, maybe wear a dress. Several of her old high school friends would be there, after all, most of whom had grown up swimming at the country club and learning to play golf. But Frankie couldn't do it. The army nurse's death had stripped her defenses down to nothing. She was barely hanging on as it was. She started the bug and backed out of the garage and headed across the island, drove up Orange Avenue, and turned left on 2nd, just a street from the park. The house was a bungalow from the 1940s, small and perfectly kept up, gray paint, a bright red door. Flowers grew in neatly tended window boxes on either side of the stone path that led from the sidewalk to the front door. Frankie got out of her car and walked very slowly to the gate, opening it, click, shutting it behind her, click. The stone path was lined on either side with flowers in bright pink bloom. She stopped at the front door, knocked, and immediately heard footsteps on the other side. Becky answered the door. For a split second, Frankie didn't recognize the beautiful young woman with bouffant blonde hair who carried a plump, blue-eyed toddler in a sailor suit on her hip.
Frankie's here, everyone!
Becky shouted so loudly that the baby in her arms started to cry. Frankie was pulled through a house cluttered with children's toys, out to the patio, where a dozen well-dressed women were sitting in folding chairs drinking champagne. A silver coffee service sat on a slim wooden table. Beside it, an array of hors d'oeuvres, pigs in a blanket, ants on a log, nut-covered balls of cheese encircled by Ritz crackers. It felt strangely discordant to Frankie that this staid, unchanging world of flowers and champagne and women in summery dresses persevered while men and women were dying in Vietnam. Frankie recognized several high school friends, girls she'd played volleyball with and gone on double dates with, a few of the cheerleaders, two or three older women, the mothers, and also saw some young women she didn't know, college friends of Dana's or relatives, perhaps. The patio was decorated with balloons. A large table held beautifully decorated gifts. It was a birthday party, she supposed. Had her mother told her that? I should have a gift, Frankie said, feeling out of place. She didn't belong in this party full of pretty housewives who wore pressed dresses and smoked Virginia Slims. Don't give it a thought, Becky said, taking her by the arm, leading her through the party to a chair near a fragrant, laden orange tree. Dana began opening gifts. Frankie tried to smile in admiration at appropriate times. She saw the way the other women oohed and awed over household items, silver candlesticks, Waterford glasses, sheets from Italy. Dana, whom Frankie barely remembered from grade school, smiled brightly at each present and said something special to the giver. Her mother sat beside her, making notes about each gift so that short work could be made of the thank you notes. A maid in a black and white uniform bustled from table to table, freshening drinks and delivering canapes. A wedding shower, Frankie realized slowly. Oh, God. Frankie snagged a glass of champagne from a nearby tray. She drank it quickly, put her empty glass down, and picked up another, and then lit up a cigarette, trying to smoke herself to calm. Then she remembered that she had to be at work at 2300 hours. She shouldn't drink before her shift at the hospital. It was just a party, nothing dangerous or frightening, but she felt anxiety ripple through her. Panic rose up. She closed her eyes, thought, "You can leave soon." But what was she so afraid of?
"Are you okay?"
She felt Becky come up beside her, smelled her floral perfume. Jean Nate, their favorite from high school. It made Frankie think of Nam and how her perfume had reminded the wounded men of their girls back home. Frankie released a breath, let it out slowly, and opened her eyes. Becky was there, tucked in close as she used to do a lifetime ago. Her smile was bright and untroubled. She seemed impossibly young, but she was Frankie's age. Frankie tried to smile, but her anxiety was so high she wasn't able to tell if she'd succeeded. "Fine," Frankie said. How long ago had Becky asked? "Fine," she said again, trying to smile.
"So, when's the wedding?"
2 months, Becky said.
"Dana is marrying Jeffrey Heller. You remember him? Football scholarship. We were all at USC together."
"Did he go to Nam?"
Becky laughed, a pretty optimistic sound.
"Of course not. Most of the boys we know have ways out. A few have gotten married."
"How fortunate."
Frankie got to her feet so quickly it must have looked like she wasn't in control of her body. And really, she wasn't. She was like an animal who had sensed danger and gone into full flight mode. If she didn't leave now, she might scream.
"I should go."
"Why? You just got here, silly."
"I have to work."
Frankie sidled to the left to give herself a clear path. Someone put a record on the stereo and turned up the volume. "We gotta get out of this place."
"Turn that shit off!" Frankie snapped.
She didn't realize that she'd yelled it until the record was scratched and the party fell quiet and everyone was staring at her. She couldn't smile.
"Sorry, I hate that song."
Becky looked frightened.
How was Florence? Chad and I are going for our anniversary."
"I wasn't in Florence, Bex," she said slowly, trying to calm down, pull back, be okay, be normal. But she wasn't okay. She was standing with a bunch of debutantes and sorority girls who were planning a wedding with fresh flowers and honeymoons abroad while men their age were dying on foreign soil. Not their men, though. Not their rich, pretty college boys. "I was in Vietnam."
Silence. Then a titter of laughter. It broke the silence. The women all joined in. Becky looked relieved.
"Funny joke, Frankie. You always were a card."
Frankie took a step closer, went toe-to-toe with her best friend from ninth grade. All the while, she was thinking, "Calm down, back off." At the same time, she thought, "Killed by enemy fire," and "Almost instantly."
"Believe me, Bex, it is not a joke. I've held men's severed legs in my hands and tried to hold their chests together just long enough to get them into the OR. What's happening in Vietnam is no joke. The joke is here. This!"
She looked around.
"You!"
She pushed past her friend and strode through the pod of silent, staring women, heard someone say, "What's wrong with her?" And before she made it outside to her car, she was screaming. Frankie sat at a picnic table in Ski Beach Park, overlooking the ocean. As usual on a summer evening, the place was crowded with people out walking their dogs or jogging in brightly colored short shorts. Kids played in the grass and in the sand, their shrieks of joy sometimes startlingly loud. She ignored all of it, or more accurately, she didn't notice the commotion going on around her. She smoked one cigarette after another, only getting up to put her butts in the trash. There was something wrong with her, and she was unsure of how to fix it. Her behavior at the shower was unacceptable on any level. There was no doubt about that. Oh, Becky and the others had been offensive about Vietnam, but so was much of the country.
That didn't give Frankie license to lash out. All she'd had to do was claim a need to leave and politely walk out of the party. Instead, her anxiety and anger had surged, come out of nowhere, and suffocated her. Even now, hours later, it was still there, lying in wait, ready to lash out at a moment's notice. It made her feel weak, shaky, fragile. She'd never thought of herself as fragile, and yet here she was, alone and afraid. She could handle a mascal in Nam with ease, but a long-forgotten friend at a bridal shower could bring her to her emotional knees with the flick of a word. Vietnam. That had to be at the root of her outburst. And how could it not? She'd shown up at a bridal shower only months after Rai's death. Wouldn't anyone be upended by grief at a time like that? But what about the sudden anger? Was that part of grief? She had to do better, be better. No more putting herself in upsetting situations. No more telling people she'd been to Vietnam. They didn't want to hear it anyway. The message was clear. Don't talk about it. She needed to do as everyone suggested and forget. She knew that enforced silence added to her anxiety, increased her anger. But it was undeniably true that even her own family was ashamed of her service and expected her to be ashamed, too. At 22:45 hours, long after dark, she was still on the wooden picnic table bench, worrying over all of it, gnawing on the bone of her failures. When she stood up, she realized she hadn't eaten all day, and the pack of cigarettes she'd smoked had left her lightheaded. She got up and walked to her car, hearing the ocean purr behind her. The park was mostly empty this late, just a few pairs of lovers out here now. She drove the short distance to the hospital and parked. Moving cautiously, she was jittery, unsteady, she entered the brightly lit halls, went to her locker, and put on her uniform. After brushing her teeth at the sink, she straightened and caught sight of herself in the mirror. A young face with old, tired eyes, black hair, and a stark white nursing cap. She headed for the nurse's station, made herself a cup of coffee, ate something from a vending machine, and began her rounds. The halls and rooms were quiet. Most of the patients were sleeping, and there were no surgeries scheduled for tonight. 4 hours later, she sat at the station desk, tapping her pen. On her shift so far, she'd changed 4 bedpans, helped 3 patients to the bathroom, and replaced 2 pillows. She'd filled water pitchers and lowered a bed and helped one old woman sleep by reading to her. As usual, she had pretty much just twiddled her thumbs. Suddenly, the elevator doors banged open. An ambulance attendant rolled a patient in on a wheeled gurney. "The ER is packed," he said. "Bus accident." Frankie shot to her feet, felt instinctively for the Kelly clamp on her fatigue pocket. "Not there." "Gunshot wound," the attendant said. Frankie felt a rush of adrenaline. "This way," she said, and ran alongside the patient, who was a young man, shot in the upper chest at close range. Blood gushed from the gaping wound, dripped onto the floor. He couldn't breathe, gasped, grabbed for her. In OR1, Frankie hit the intercom. "Code, Bay 1, code, Bay 1. To the attendant, Frankie said, "Get him on the table." "There's no doc." "On the table," she shouted, washing her hands, looking for gloves. "Now." The attendant moved the kid onto the operating table. Frankie masked and scrubbed up and hurried back to the table. "You're going to be okay," she said to the young man. He gurgled, gasped, clawed at his throat. Something was obstructing his breathing. Frankie went to the intercom again, hit the button with her elbow, and called for help, this time saying, "Code blue, stat, OR, Bay 1. "Hang on, kid," she said. "The doc will be here soon." The patient gasped, started to turn blue. Frankie glanced back at the door. Didn't these people listen? Did they not respond to calls? She waited 5 more seconds, then found the surgical cart, grabbed some antiseptic ointment and a scalpel and a breathing tube. He was dying. She wiped his neck with antiseptic and picked up a scalpel. It took less than 20 seconds to do the tracheotomy and get the kid breathing. There, she said when he inhaled and exhaled through the tube. She cut off his shirt and vest, exposing the wound. It was gushing blood. She grabbed some gauze, applied pressure, and tried to stop the bleeding. A short-haired man in scrubs rushed into the OR and stopped in his tracks.
What in the hell?
Frankie threw him an irritated look. There you are. What took you so long? The doctor stared at her, his mouth open. Mrs. Henderson appeared beside him. She looked at Frankie, her face no doubt streaked with the patient's blood, her white nurse uniform stained red in places, her cap thrown to the floor, applying pressure to a patient's wound.
Who did the trach?
The doctor asked, looking around.
He couldn't breathe, Frankie said. So you performed a trach?
You? The doctor said.
I called. No one came, Frankie said. We have other emergencies, he said. Tell that to this kid.
The doctor turned, said, Mrs. Henderson, get a team here, now. He went to wash his hands. Frankie felt flushed with pride. She had shown them her skills, saved this young man, maybe. Mrs. Henderson stood there, her arms crossed, her hair frizzed out around her white, starched cap, her forehead pleated, her mouth set in a grim line.
You could have killed that man.
I saved him, ma'am.
Who do you think you are?
I'm a combat nurse, a good one.
That may be, Mrs. Henderson said. But you're also a loose cannon. You have just exposed this hospital to liability. You're fired.
22. Headlights shone on the elaborately scrolled metal in front of her, illuminating the gold M in the center of the gates. When Frankie was young, this house had been neither gated nor walled, but open to the world, situated proudly on its large, ocean-facing lot. Back then, Ocean Boulevard had been a quiet street, mostly driven on by locals. The world had felt safe. The assassination of President Kennedy had changed everything. She still sometimes thought of her childhood as before and after. Following the death of the president, no one in America had felt safe from the Red Scare, and up had gone the wall around the McGrath property. Not long after that, the gate had closed them in, created an oasis designed to shield the inhabitants from the ugliness of life. As if bricks and mortar could protect a person. Frankie drove through the open gate and followed the driveway into the four-car garage where she parked beside her mother's Cadillac. Her father's silver gull-wing Mercedes was off to the left. She realized too late, when she was nearly at the front door, that she'd forgotten her purse. Feeling unsteady, she walked back, retrieved her purse, got out her keys, and opened the front door. It was 0400 hours, quiet, dark. A single lamp in the living room cast a little light, but otherwise the rooms lay in shadow. Frankie could have navigated this house blindfolded, so she didn't bother with any lights. She walked into the living room, grabbed a bottle of booze and a glass from the bar, and carried them out to the patio. Fired. For saving a young man's life. What was going on in the world? She needed to eat something. Why that came to mind, she had no idea. She poured a glass of vodka, apparently, and drank it fast and poured another. She needed something to dim the pain, at least to give it a blunt edge. She needed to get herself together. Her mind was a whirlwind, anger, fear, grief, sorrow. Every now and then she cried. Then she'd scream. Neither helped at all. God help her, she missed Vietnam, missed who she'd been over there. She closed her eyes, tried to steady her breathing. She heard footsteps. How long had she been out here, drinking and smoking and crying? And how could she still have tears to shed? It dawned on her suddenly that it was daylight, so she'd been out here for hours. The lights flicked on. Her father strode out onto the porch in his pajamas and monogrammed robe. He saw her and stopped.
What in the Sam Hill?
Mom came out behind him, still in her silk pajamas.
Francis, what happened? Are you okay?
Frankie realized that she was still in her blood-splattered white nurse uniform. At some point, her cap had fallen off. There was blood all down her front, on her white pantyhose, on her shoes.
I saved a man's life in the hospital tonight. Performed a tracheotomy.
You?
Her father said, one eyebrow cocked in disbelief.
Yes, Dad. Me.
We heard about the scene you caused at Becky's party, he said.
For a second, she didn't know what he was talking about. Yesterday afternoon felt like a lifetime ago. At the suddenness of the topic change, she stumbled into confusion, lost her sweeping anger. She didn't want to disappoint them. Again.
I didn't mean to cause a scene. It's just...
Well, you did. No doubt the story will be all over the club by now. Connor McGrath's daughter went to Vietnam and came home crazy.
Are you taking drugs? Mom asked, twining her hands together.
What? Drugs? No, Frankie said. It's just the way people look at me when I say I was in Nam.
You exposed my fib about Florence,
Dad said.
Fib?
Frankie couldn't believe he'd said that.
Fib?
She knew then what this was about, what it had always been about. His reputation. The man with his stupid hero's wall who knew nothing about heroism and lived in fear of that embarrassing truth being exposed.
If you don't want to be seen as a liar, maybe you shouldn't lie, Dad. Maybe you should be proud of me.
Proud? That you embarrass this family at every turn?
I went to war, Dad. War! I have been shot at in a Huey and lived through mortar attacks. I've had my ears ring for days when a bomb hit too close. But you don't know anything about that, do you?
He paled at that, clenched his jaw.
Enough, he said.
You're right,
she yelled back. She pushed past him, headed to her bedroom before she could say something even worse. The door to her father's office was open. She saw all those pictures and mementos on the hero's wall, and without thinking, she went into the sacred space and started pulling the framed pictures off the wall, throwing them to the floor. She heard glass shatter.
What the hell do you think you're doing?
Dad roared at her from the doorway.
This, she said, your hero's wall! It's a big fat lie, isn't it, Dad? You wouldn't know a hero if one bit you in the ass. Believe me, Dad, I've seen heroes.
Your brother would be as ashamed of your behavior as we are,
Dad said. Mom appeared in the doorway, threw Dad a pleading look.
Connor, don't. How dare you mention Finley,
Frankie said, her anger swooping back in.
You who got him killed. He went over there for you, to make you proud. I could tell him now not to bother, couldn't I? Oh, but he's dead.
Out,
her father said, in barely above a whisper.
Get out of this house and stay out.
With pleasure,
Frankie hissed. She snagged the photograph of her brother and stormed out of the office.
Leave that picture,
Dad said. She turned around.
No way. He's not staying in this toxic house. You got him killed, Dad. How do you live with that?
She ran down to her bedroom, stuffed a few things in her overnight travel bag, grabbed her purse, and left the house. Outside, she felt the sting of regret, and tears blurred her vision.
Dear God, she was sick to death of crying, and of these mammoth mood swings. She shouldn't have said that terrible thing to her father.
She threw her stuff in the back seat, along with the portrait of Finley, and climbed into the bug, slamming the door shut behind her. She knew she was driving on Ocean Boulevard too fast, but it couldn't be helped. She couldn't catch her breath. She felt like the last girl in a horror film running for her life. But the danger wasn't behind her, trying to catch up. It was inside her, trying to break out. She thought, if it gets out, something bad will happen. All this rage and hurt could destroy her if she didn't bottle it up. She reached over for her purse, felt around for her cigarettes in the mess inside. The music blared through the small black speakers. Light my fire. For a second, she felt it all. The missing of herself, of Vietnam, of her lost loves. Tears blurred her eyes. She couldn't lift her hand to wipe them away. She pressed her foot on the gas when she meant to ease off. A flash of something. Color. A streetlight, a dog darting in front of her. She swerved and slammed on the brakes so hard she was flung forward, cracked her head on the steering wheel. Where was she? She came to slowly, saw the crunched wreckage of the VW Bug's hood. She'd hit a street lamp, gone up onto the curb. She could have killed someone. Jesus, she said, in both relief and prayer. Her whole body was shaking. She felt sick. She couldn't go on like this. She needed help. And she couldn't go back to her parents. Not yet, maybe not ever, after what she'd said to her father. She put the Bug in reverse and backed up. The car clanged down onto the street. A dog sat on the grass, watching her. Frankie had never hated herself more than she did right now. She was hungry, broken-hearted, and drunk, and she'd gotten behind the wheel. She parked the wrecked car on the side of the road and left her keys in it. In this neighborhood, the police would be alerted to its presence in no time. They'd call the registered owner, Connor McGrath, and he'd see it sitting here, broken. She hoped it scared him. Who had she become that she wished pain on someone she loved? Slinging her bag and purse over her shoulder, she stumbled down the street. It wasn't until she boarded the ferry and saw how people stared at her that she realized she was still in her bloody white uniform. She went into the bathroom and changed into jeans and a t-shirt. She had forgotten to pack shoes, so she left her blood-splattered white nurse shoes on. On the mainland, she walked to the bus station. Every step took something out of her, made her feel smaller, more worthless, more lost, more alone. Who could help her? There was only one place she could think of. She boarded a city bus and exited a few miles later, then walked to the Veterans Administration Outpatient Clinic. The offices were closed when she arrived. She sat on a bench out front, smoking one cigarette after another, waiting impatiently, reliving the bad things she'd said and seen and done over and over. At 08:30 hours, the lights in the building came on. Cars began to drive into the parking lot. Frankie walked inside. A wide lobby funneled into a beige hallway. Men sat slumped in chairs that lined either wall, some of them younger, long-haired, wearing ratty clothes, fatigues with the sleeves cut off, denim jackets, torn t-shirts. And some were older men, probably veterans from Korea or World War II. A few walked back and forth. She stopped at the front desk.
I need some help, she said. Something's wrong.
The woman behind the desk looked up. What kind of help? Frankie touched her head, the new bruise that was forming. A headache made it hard to think.
I am
crazy, unraveling. What?
My thoughts? I get angry and sad, and my boyfriend was just killed in action.
The woman stared at her a moment, clearly confused.
Well, I mean, this is the VA.
Oh, right. I'm an Army Nurse Corps vet, just back from Nam.
The woman gave her a skeptical look.
Dr. Durfee is in his office. He doesn't have an appointment until 9 a.m. I guess you could...
Thanks.
She sighed.
Two doors down, on the left.
Frankie headed down the wide hallway, where more men sat on plastic seats beneath a framed portrait of Richard Nixon. Frankie saw posters and brochures offering different kinds of help to veterans, employment help, state benefits, education, and training. At Dr. Durfee's door, she stopped, took a deep breath, and knocked.
Come in.
She opened the door and stepped into a narrow, almost closet-small office. An old man, old enough to be her grandfather, sat behind a cluttered desk. Stacks of paper were on every surface in the room. A poster was tacked up on the wall behind him, a kitten hanging from one claw with the words, "Hang tough." The doctor peered at her through black-rimmed, Coke-bottle-thick glasses. What strands of hair he had left, he'd combed to one side and maybe sprayed in place. He wore a Madras shirt buttoned to his wattled neck.
Hello, young lady. Are you lost?
Frankie smiled tiredly. It was such a relief to be here, to say, I need help, and receive it.
I am lost, but I'm in the right place. I probably should have come before now.
His gaze narrowed, moved from her face, down her rumpled blouse and wrinkled jeans, to the red-splattered white shoes.
The woman at the front desk said you had until 9. I can make an appointment, but I really need some help now, if you don't mind.
Help?
She sank into the chair in front of his desk.
I was in country for 2 years, and my boyfriend was supposed to come home in April, but he was KIA, so what came was a "we regret to inform you" telegram. And the way people treat us. We can't even say Vietnam. We went to serve our country, and now they call us baby killers. My dad can't look at me. At my job, I was fired for being too good, even though I might have saved a young man's life. And I can't seem to get a handle on my emotions since I got back. I'm always either banshee angry or bursting into tears. My dad is so ashamed he said I went to Florence.
She said it all in a rush and felt exhausted afterward.
Are you menstruating now?
Frankie took a moment to process that.
I tell you that I'm having trouble after being in Vietnam, and that's your question?
You were in Vietnam? There were no women in Vietnam, dear. Do you have thoughts of hurting yourself, hurting others?
Frankie got slowly to her feet. It felt nearly impossible to do so.
You won't help me?
I'm here for veterans.
I am a veteran.
In combat?
Well, no, but...
See? So you'll be fine. Trust me. Go home. Go out with friends. Fall in love again. You're young. Just forget about Vietnam.
Just forget. It was what everyone recommended. Why couldn't she do it? The doctor was right. She hadn't seen combat, hadn't been wounded or tortured. Why couldn't she forget? She turned and walked out of the office, past the men sitting in chairs along the wall, under the watchful eyes of President Nixon. In the lobby, she saw a payphone and thought, Barb, and stopped. She needed her best friend to talk her down from this ledge of despair. She went to the phone, made a collect call. Barb answered on the second ring.
Hello?
This is the operator. Will you accept a collect call from Frankie McGrath?
Yes, Barb said quickly. The operator clicked off the line.
Frankie, what's wrong?
I'm sorry, I know it's expensive to call collect.
Francis, what's wrong?
I don't know, but I'm in bad shape, Barb. I'm kind of falling apart here.
She tried to make herself laugh, to lighten it, and couldn't.
My parents threw me out. I crashed my car. I was fired. And that was just the last 24 hours.
Oh, Frankie.
The compassion in Barb's voice was Frankie's undoing. She started crying, pathetic, and couldn't stop.
I need help!
Where are you?
At the useless VA!
Is there somewhere you could go?
She couldn't think. She was still crying.
Frankie!
She wiped her eyes.
The Crystal Pier cottages aren't far away. Finley and I used to ride bikes on the pier.
Go, get a room, eat something, and don't leave, okay? I'm on my way. You hear me?
Oh, it's too expensive to fly, Barb.
Don't leave, Frankie. Get a room at the Crystal Pier and stay there. I mean it.
Someone was pounding on the door. Frankie sat up, immediately felt sick to her stomach. An empty gin bottle lay on the carpet by the bed.
Open the damn door, Frankie!
Barb. Frankie looked blearily around the cottage she'd rented, saw the empty gin bottle, an overflowing ashtray, empty potato chip bags. No wonder she felt like hell. She climbed out of bed and went to the door, unlocking it, letting it swing open. Barb and Ethel stood there, side by side, both with worried looks on their faces.
I don't know what's wrong with me,
Frankie said. Her voice was hoarse. She'd been screaming in her sleep again. Barb was the first to take Frankie in her arms. Ethel moved in beside them, wrapped her strong arms around both of them.
I'd rather be in Pleiku, Frankie said. At least there I know when to put on my flak jacket. Here.
Yeah, Barb said.
I don't know what to do, who I am now, without the army or Rye. My dad threw me out of the house. I just want, I don't know, for someone to care that I'm home, that I went.
We care, Ethel said. That's why we're here. And we came up with a plan on the way here. Frankie pushed the damp, greasy bangs out of her face.
A plan for what?
Your future.
Do I get a say in it?
She asked sarcastically, but really, she didn't care. She just wanted her friends to save her. No, Ethel said. That was our first decision. When your girl calls and says, I need help, you help. So don't think you can change your mind now. Frankie nodded. Behind her friends, she saw a yellow cab idling at the curb. Get your stuff, Barb said. Frankie felt too crappy to argue or question, and more relieved than she could say. She went into the bathroom, brushed her teeth and put on pants, then tossed her bloody nurse shoes in the trash and walked out barefoot.
So, what am I doing to fix my life?
Frankie asked as the three of them walked to the waiting cab. Her girlfriends bookended her, stayed close, as if they were afraid she'd bolt. Frankie tossed her overnight bag into the car, then slid into the back seat with Barb on one side and Ethel on the other.
Train station,
Ethel said to the driver. At the same time, Barb said,
We checked you out of the motel, Frankie, so sit tight.
The taxi drove back down the pier, tires bumping over the rough wood.
Where are we going?
Frankie asked.
My dad's farm near Charlottesville, Ethel said. You two are moving into the bunkhouse. We'll remodel it ourselves. Give us a legit reason to hit things. I'm going to finish school. Barb joined that new organization, Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
Frankie turned.
You're against the war now?
It's gotta stop, Frankie. I don't know if this can help, and I sure as hell don't want to be a part of some privileged white kids picketing something they know nothing about. But this, the VVAW, is about us having a voice, the veterans. Don't you think someone should listen to us?
Frankie didn't know how she felt about that.
And me. What have you two decided on for me?
That's what we're giving you, Ethel said. Time to figure it out.
If Frankie hadn't been so sick of crying, so emptied out, she would have cried. Thank God for girlfriends. In this crazy, chaotic, divided world that was run by men, you could count on the women.
This bunkhouse, Frankie said. Is there indoor plumbing?
Ethel's face transformed with a smile, revealing how nervous she'd been that Frankie would say no to this bold plan.
Why? You too good for a latrine, Lieutenant?
Frankie smiled for the first time in how long? She didn't even know.
No, ma'am. With you two at my side, I can live in practically anything.
Barb held out her hand. The three put their hands together.
Enough bad memories, she said solemnly. We won't ever forget, God knows, but we move forward, away from Vietnam, into the future.
It felt solemn and important and suddenly possible. Frankie thought, I won't talk about it anymore. I will forget. Soldier on. Away, they said in one voice. They stopped only long enough to get Frankie a new pair of shoes.